Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Love What You Play online events and podcasts. Today, I'm really excited to have an opportunity to talk to Ken Martell, the technical director for USA Hockey. He's also a regional ADM manager for California and has 25 years of coaching development in hockey. He's been behind the bench with USA Hockey in a number of roles, including the World Junior teams, the Women's National Team, the IIHF World Championship teams, and also has playing experience to the high level where he played in university for Lake Superior State when they won their first national title in 1988. So really, really looking forward to our chat, just like I was with Bob Mancini. Let's go.
Yeah. All right.
All right. So first question I ask everybody is, where did you grow up and what did you play as a kid?
I grew up in Southern California, if you believe it. Played all my hockey out there through 16 years of age when I left to play junior hockey. But like a lot of kids my age, played a lot of sports, whether it was organized, unorganized. Some of it was just lots of backyard games with friends and, you know, some stickball and you name it growing up. But hockey was sort of my love, even though I was in a warm weather climate.
So when did hockey become your love to pursue long term?
I think I always knew I wanted to try and be a hockey player at some level.
And that kind of precursors, we kind of touch on as we were chatting, what are some of the issues just in general that parents are facing today to keep their kids active and keep them in sport? Maybe the hockey model as an example.
You know, I think a lot, one of the good things about my job is I do get a chance to share with a lot of the other NGVs that we have here in the United States, whether it's lacrosse, swimming, volleyball, you know, across the board. And we all share a lot of common youth sports cultural problems. I think for parents, it's time, the time commitment to do some things. You know, US for us, we're a facilities-based sport, and your local ice arena might not be so local. It may take a, you know, 30, 40 minute drive maybe, and that's the closest rink to your house.
Right.
Some areas of, you know, so the time commitment, I think a lot of youth sports have made youth sports very expensive or a lot more expensive than it needs to be. I'm certainly not against making money in youth sports, but I think there's a way to do it that it doesn't drive up the costs exorbitantly and, you know, actually has some real good benefits for the kids. So I think those are some challenges that every youth sport facing.
Yeah, pretty much everybody I talk to, it doesn't matter what sport it is. It you know, time commitment is really kind of pushing some kids out of the game. The financial commitment, the pay-to-play model, is not just in the U.S. It's now evolving in Canada.
Yeah.
With the academies, they're exploding everywhere. I think the last number I had in B.C. was we have 23 academies, whereas 5 years ago when my son was in that pipeline, was about half that. So they just continue to grow, and, you know, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 a year for the kid to be in a hockey academy, that's a lot of money for a lot of parents, and they don't see their kid for, you know, 6-7 months of the year. So it's a huge issue.
We try and tell a lot of our parents, you know, that you get good at your local ice arena, but you really do. Competition, I think, is overrated, especially at the younger ages. Yeah. We don't need to chase that as much as parents and people think. Usually there's a team of kids not too far up the road that are of similar ilk to you that you can play. You don't need to get on an airplane and fly halfway across the United States to find someone that you think is, well, you know, better competition. it's that that drives the cost up. And, you know, going to your local ice arena is not as expensive as people think. It's all the ancillary costs we tack onto it that really drive it up.
Yeah, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, no.
One of the people I talked to is Topher Scott, and he's got this organization called the Hockey Think Tank. Yeah. And he wrote a great blog called The Cost of AAA Hockey, and he played Cornell at high level. And he's going, it's crazy. It was back and forth and stuff like that. And it's one of the things that pushed both me and then, ironically, my kid out of the game, because the big driver that so many coaches are doing now is they want to go on travel tournaments. And, you know, when you do a travel tournament, if you're doing planes, trains, automobiles, it's on average $3,000 for you and your son or daughter to go wherever. And he gave me a statistic about the Western-based teams that are aspiring to play Eastern higher-level competition. He goes, it's crazy how many of them are 7, 8, 9 tournaments a year. And I'm like, what? I thought it was bad with 3 or 4.
Well, you know, I think there was a time, like, so I grew up in California, like I said, the time when I can tell you that my kids that I played night and squirt hockey with when I was growing up in Southern California, there were 9 of us that left our local youth program to go and play eventually at some level. And 5 were scholarship college hockey players, 2 played in the CHL, 1 played, or 2 more played small college, Division III college, but 1 was a Division III All-American. And out of that 9, 3 played in the NHL. And there were other kids in my birth year growing up that played in California that played in the National Hockey League. And it didn't, I didn't play on my youth team. And we left the state, and we left Southern California once a year. Again, you get good at your local rink. It's so overrated what they're selling to people. But, you know, it's social media, it's everything else that hypes things, and we just need to relax, patience, you know?
Yeah, and one of the big drivers is parents being concerned whether or not their son or daughter is going to be scouted. And one of the big challenges that I face doing clinics is I'll have the coaches say, well, you know, we're coaching Adam, which is our 9, 10-year-old that believes the same as yours, and parents are complaining now. They're appealing when a kid is released from a AAA or an A1 team, depending on where you're at, down to the A2, the B team. And then the argument is they're not going to be scouted. I'm like, what? Like, scouts aren't even looking at these kids till 13, 14, 15, even when they get on a radar screen. So how do you deal with that?
Well, and in reality, nobody in the real hockey world cares what you do until much, much later than that. You know, the National Hockey League, the college hockey, junior hockey, like, they care about what you show up at 17, 18, 19, 20 years, 23, right? It's not those younger ages. I mean, the evidence of sport, we really don't know how things are going to shake out until after every kid goes through puberty and has some time to work on things. You know, so the last time I looked, 16-17% of the National Hockey League was undrafted. That's 2 out of every 12 players that are on the ice every shift that no one at 18, 19 years of age thought were good enough to play. So kids still make it to a very, very high level, even much later. The average rookie in the NHL, you know, you throw out all the statistics, but it's not – the Connor McDavids, the Austin Matthews, those guys, those are aberrations. That's not how most players get into the league.
Yeah, they're special. Like, they're special. There's great, and they're right up there. And then the rest are kind of playing catch up. I mean, when you're 7 kilometers an hour faster than anybody on the ice, that's special, right?
Exactly.
You're absolutely right. So late bloomers, and that's what I try to tell everybody. You've got to wait until they're late teens before you really get a sniff. A good analogy is Jamie Benn. Look at what he accomplished.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He wasn't even a Hockey Canada's radar screen until when he was 19 in the World Juniors. That was the first time they kind of went, yeah, you know, this guy's potential. Look where he is now.
Oh, I mean, the story, I mean, there's lots of those kind of stories out there. But, you know, again, patience. You just don't know how things are going to shake out in the wash till well after puberty's over with, and which kids are persistent and love it. And that's why one of our taglines with our program is Play, Love, Excel. We really want them to get involved, play, want to fall in love with it, because we know that long term, the only way they're going to put the time in necessary, you know, down the road or stick with it, is if they truly have a passion for it and love it. So,
yeah, and if they're robotic and there's too much structure, they're probably going to go jump on the bandwagon for another sport, just quit completely. So,
absolutely,
building that whole passion for the sport and then passion for being active. Mm-hmm. What then can coaches do, and what are great characteristics of coaches in your program?
Well, first, for youth coaches, it's patience. It's really understanding that this is a long, slow process, and not every kid is going to develop at the same rate. Just be patient. The kid that you think is the best one at 9 may not be, usually isn't later on. So it just have patience. Always in the back of your head, understand that it's player centered first. It's about your players, not about you. As the coach, you really need to a lot of times take the back seat. You walk into the rink and you'll see coaches yelling and screaming from the bench. It's like trying to, you know, ridiculous. Kids can't. It's analysis to paralysis for the poor kids, you know. It's their game. They're the ones. Once the game starts, they got to go out and play. Just let them go. You know, but it's about the kids. And then, you know, if you understood, it's more about how you coach than necessarily what you coach all the time. We do this exercise in our coaching clinics. We ask all of our youth coaches to say, okay, well, think back to any youth sport that you ever played and the best coach you ever had. And I want you to write down on a little sticky note, what was the best about that coach? What made them the best? Okay, now I want you to get up and want you to go over the board. And on this side over here, I want you to put up how to coach. It falls in that category. And then on this side over here, what to coach. Well, invariably, 95% of the board is covered on the what. It's how they treated how did they treat you, how they made you feel. All of those things, what made them a great coach. It wasn't because they, you know, were a great tactician and, you know, could teach you the 1-2-2 forecheck and, you know, whatever. I mean, that's what coaching is. So those are the three things, really, if I think can get coaches. If we just wrapped our heads around those things, we'd be.
Yeah, I'm glad you nailed that. It's funny, the sticky note exercise I've been doing for many years under the Changing the Game project, we call that how side, the connection, which is, you know, 4 C's, Wade Gilbert, John Cote, all the stuff they're doing. And then the knowledge side. And probably the record of all the ones that I've done, I had a group in Edmonton. I did a talks for Edmonton Lacrosse, and they brought in all of their coaches. It was mandatory, about 360 in the room. And when the how side was pummeled, and then the other side, there was like 10 sticky notes by the third year I did it, because they finally started shifting over to that whole how concept. So yeah, it's pretty amazing how that evolves.
That's a great visual.
Yeah, and that's why we do it with the sticky notes, because I used to do it with, you know, you write on the chalkboard. And then I did initially 10, 12 years ago, I was doing clinics, is tell me the characteristics of great coaches. So we write them down. We do the polar opposites for this is what you don't want to do. But when you do the sticky note, it's like it shows how many people on that one side, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a great way to do it. How important then is it for coaches to understand, you talked about the how, to continue with their coaching development after they've done their certification?
You know, the formalized education programs a lot of NGBs and NSOs have, it's nice, but it's not making you a coach. You know, it's really the experience and that continued passion that a lot of guys have to keep looking at all the new things. You know, the minute you stop learning, you're that's just the way it is, for especially for elite coaches. The best coaches I know are the ones that are the continued learners. I've got a friend over at USA Volleyball. I'm sure you've probably run across John Kessel.
He's doing this event.
Is he? Okay. I had a great, so John's fantastic. Been around forever and ever. And not only is John a lifelong learner, but he's a lifelong sharer of information. You know, we've got a guy in our office here, Lou Vero, coached our 84 Olympic team, been around for forever and ever. And he was good friends with Anatoly Tarasov, great hockey Russian coach. And, you know, Tarasov would always tell him, you know, today's secret is tomorrow's common knowledge. All you got to do is go watch somebody play one, right? So, you know, why not just be open and share and, you know, help everybody? It just elevates the game.
Yeah, and probably a great analogy on that front is Claire Drake, who's the Canadian's version of John Wooden. And mm-hmm. he was infamous for sharing everything. And I've talked to a lot of coaches in clinics over the years that mm-hmm. either played for him or had an opportunity to be coached by him. And they said, you know, he'd share it all out, but you couldn't beat him anyway because he was always a step ahead of everybody. And his infamous quote that I share it all the time, if you're done learning, you're done. Right. And he was still taking notes like 20 years after he stopped, he retired. Same with John Wooden, because they might learn something. So, but it's getting those, getting coaches. Just last week, I was at an event that, you know, Matt Young, and he did his mm-hmm. video on, so you were doing a screening of cost of winning, and there's three coaches with me. And one of them was just complaining about the amount of time they had to commit to coach. And I'm saying, well, You know you're working with kids, right? And how are you going to get better as a coach if you don't continue to learn? He goes, oh, there's too much of a time commitment to actually do the coaching itself. If you get that objection from coaches, and then there's the money side. Oh, it's too much of a financial commitment. Well, yeah. There's so much available online.
Yeah. That's the difficult part. We, from USA Hockey's perspective, we try and put as much as online. We usually don't have a paywall. Trying to keep information from all of our coaches. We want the information out, but yeah, it does take a lot of work. I mean, to be good at anything takes a lot of time and effort. You know, we've got friends that coach over in Europe and some of those countries that are pretty good in ice hockey. And like, they'll tell you, look, our children are our greatest resource. You know, why would we allow just anybody to coach, for one? And if they don't have the right mindset on continued improvement, then why would we want to allow them to be around our kids? Do we want that same mindset for our children?
Yeah.
So, you know, role model the continuing education on your side too, right?
Well, it's like the teacher model, the professional development they're required to do monthly. In my eyes, it should be. And we're starting to go there in Canada with our National Coaches Certification Program. But one of the biggest challenges is they kind of, they didn't really communicate it well. And then all of a sudden everybody was like, you got to have X number of PD credits by X date. And they're like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm totally for it. But I think we need to be able to communicate how they can get it and all that kind of stuff. So they will do it and be better for the game. So.
Well, and here's the thing too, you know, we have the same issue. If you look at a National Hockey League or a high end elite level game today, and you compare it side by side with 15 years ago, the game looks different.
Yeah.
It is different. I mean, there are things that were common practice when I was growing up or when we were younger that, you know, if you were a defenseman when I grew up and you passed the puck in front of your own net, that was the coach saying, get off. Yeah, you know, open guy. Like, the game, I can tell you two things about our sport. It's not getting slower and the players aren't getting less interchangeable. It's constantly evolving. So if you don't open yourself up to looking at how the game of not just today is being played, but even project what the game of the future is going to be, you're really doing your players a disservice, because if they're 10, 11, 12 years of age now, and you're just dealing with what the game looks like today or yesterday, then they won't have the tool set that they need to be successful later on. So this is where that continuing education kind of falls in line. You just, as a coach, you got to keep up.
Yeah, so that you can help your, I mean, the ultimate goal is we're all in it for the big main reason is for the kids.
Yeah.
You help them become great players, the best they can be, not the best ever, which is.
Yeah, for sure.
And best people they can become, because that's 99% of these kids or even more – probably not going to a really, really high level, but hopefully become great people through this process and learn a ton of life lessons by being part of youth sports. So that's always been my goal, and whenever kid I've coached, and hopefully that's the same with a lot of other coaches getting in it for the right reason.
So when they end up being your future administrators, your future officials, your future coaches, you know, future adult players, the ones that help perpetuate the sport and down the
road. Yeah, and ultimately grow it. So shifting into your USA Hockey world, is there what does a typical day look like for you, or is there such a thing? Because you're all over the place.
I don't think there's a typical day for really anybody on our staff. We're not a big staff, and it's always that line at the bottom of the job application that says "and other duties as a staff." I think that column or that line item gets used more often than anything else. But we have a great group of people that we get a chance to work with, and you know, because everybody's so willing to just jump in and get done whatever needs to get done, your job. You don't really have a job description sometimes.
And in terms of when did you actually get involved to start with? Like how far back when you jumped on the USA Hockey bandwagon?
Well, I sort of have two lives with USA Hockey, and they to be honest, they have very little to do with each other. My original, I came on board as a national team coach and did that. And that was very compartmentalized to those older kids. And then I ended up switching over because we needed just more people doing coach education and player development projects and those things. And it's, you know, the things that have prepared me to coach, say, with our world junior team, for example, have very little to do with what it takes to be successful coaching 8 and unders. You know, so, you know, it's again, two different worlds almost. There are some things you can take, but it's really a different skill set, a different mindset that's required. And I've loved every minute of this part of my job, which I've been doing for about 12 years now.
And when you first got involved at that, and 12 years back, how many kids were registered then? How many are now? And what's the percentage ratio, girls to boys?
You know, well, we just had our registration numbers for this past season come out. So we're about 653,000 total registered members. 568,000 of them are players. Now, some of that's adult players. And if you look at just girls 19U and below, about 64,000 registered females, and 18 and under, we're 387,000 boys.
So your percentage for girls is pretty close, because Hockey Canada is about 625 total.
Yeah.
That's players. That's not the adult. Like the adult rec is a totally separate. And girls of that has grown to about 85,000 over the last 10 years. So about 15% of your membership is girls now?
Maybe a little bit more. And it's one of the fastest growing segments we have.
Yeah.
We're growing pretty much at all levels, but girls certainly has been the last 10 years probably more rapid than boys.
And what just happened at the All-Star game was pretty special to see.
Oh, it's fantastic, yeah.
She took that lap. I was like, and all the players are sitting on the bench going, wow.
Oh, yeah.
The developments on that side as well.
Yeah, for sure.
In terms of the actual ADM model, you know Mike Butters? Seen ring any bells?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah, ADM Junior Council. How long did you research it before you actually pulled the trigger to roll it out?
You know, we were probably about 18 months of background on it. The timing was pretty good for us. You know, some of the things I don't think which are common knowledge were, when I first started with USA Hockey, there were more players playing in the province of Ontario than there were in all of the United States, late 90s. So we've grown considerably, but there was a from about 1990 to maybe around 2001, USA Hockey was on a really nice upward trend. And then it sort of slowed down and plateaued a little bit. And unbeknownst to us, at least initially, overall numbers were growing. We were growing a little bit at girls, but a lot at adult. And we were declining pretty rapidly in male youth players. Mm-hmm. A little over 40,000 male youth players, somewhere from around 2001 to 2006, 7, right in that area. So not only did we were on a downward trend. So it was about the same time that we started looking and doing some of this research and said, look, okay, a couple of things motivated us. One was, okay, what's going on here? And we need to stop the bleeding. And then two, you know, we're a competitive country. We want to be good at the sport. We want to grow. I mean, don't kid yourself. Our long-term goal is to be the best hockey playing nation in the planet. It may take 60 years, who knows, but that's our goal. And we're like everybody else, but we know that there's some great hockey playing nations out there that do a wonderful job. And for us, it's let's focus on the grassroots levels. Let's really get that sorted out and firmed up a bit. You know, I mean, when we really started to take a good internal look, we figured out pretty quickly that we were less broken, so to speak, at the older levels, and the younger you went, the more out of whack we probably were. So that's where we kind of put most of our efforts with this.
And when go ahead. There's a buffering going on, so that's why I'm not trying to cut you off.
Yeah, no worries.
Sorry, finish your sentence.
No, we just put our efforts into growing and working with our youngest age groups. I mean, when kids start off, and if we can get them into our sport and off on the right foot, help them build a bit of love for the game, well, then maybe they, you know, turn around and stick with it. And our numbers have not only been able to stop the bleeding, but moving in a different direction and have grown considerably. So it's a good thing for us.
So that 40,000 number, is that when your experience is 60% attrition? By
PhD, yeah, sure.
Because Bob shared that number, and the things that you did to kind of reverse the trends. One is you investigated, start rolling out the ADM. But what I thought was very interesting, it was, you know, we're going to focus on the coaching development. We want to make it fun and all kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then you said the big thing was when you canceled your U-12 national championship, and that kind of eased the tension right across the board because people were getting too fixated. Is that true?
I think, I think there's still people that are way too fixated on at 12U what they think is, you know, the Stanley Cup championship. But, I mean, the one thing about our organization is we try hard not to be hypocritical about what we do. And for us, you were seeing at the time people putting together their recruiting their 10U team so that they could have them together for a few years, their super team, so that they're ready to go for the 12U national championships, right? So for us as an organization, if we're trying to preach, slow it down a little bit, and we're out running an event that is maybe the most high-profile 12 and under event in our country, that's not setting a very good example. So, you know, kudos to our board and, for making that change, along with some others that certainly help. It's not just one thing, it's a lot of different things.
Yeah, which is great, because instead of you seeing the bleeding, you're actually going this way. You and lacrosse, from what I know, are still doing this, whereas other sports are seeing the decline. So one of those things will be the rollout of the ADM. When you first did it, what kind of pushback, if any, did you get from parents?
You know, well, first off, I have to give some credit to our friends across the border up in Canada, because we had some people there that were very influential with us, helped us out considerably in putting together what we wanted to do. And for us, there was certainly some pushback. We already had a mandatory coach education program in place. So every coach that was going to get behind a bench in a game had to at least go through some class clinic, you know, that we were running. And again, like I said, does that make him a coach? No, but at least they were getting exposed to some messaging that we wanted. We knew that we had this delivery mechanism that was already in place. So we really kind of attacked that hard because, let's face it, they're the frontline deliverers of content and experience when kids come to the rink. So we spent a lot of our time and effort there with some in-classroom work and then some online support modules and things based on the age category that the coaches were working with. And more than anything else, I think it really helped create a common language from one end of the country to the other. We're a big country, and having people hear the same message in California as they are in Maine or Massachusetts or Michigan, Minnesota or Florida was helpful for us in changing some things. Our biggest pushback, and we still have our detractors, so to speak, and they tend to be people that have a long history in the sport. And we know as human beings, change is not easy, and people just don't like change. We found that the greatest acceptance is with people that are new coming in, because they just look at things at face value and go, well, this makes too much sense. Yep, no problem. So that's where we've had it. And to your point, when we were talking offline before, we don't have the staff or the wherewithal to get to every program around our country. So we just feed the good ones. We feed the ones that want to be fed. You know, we go where we're asked to go, right? So organizations that are out there across our country that want help and assistance, you know what? We'll have a professional with a smile on their face show up, you know, at your local club and help you out with the problems that you have in your environment. That's really what's made us successful. And again, our staff's made up of ex-NHL coaches, Division I college coaches, people that have played and worked at a very high level in the sport that decided, you know what, I'm going to be the best youth development person on the planet. That's their goal. They've changed their mindset and on what they do, and that's been super helpful for our membership. And we, you know, just go with the ones that want the help and where we're wanted. We don't have time to worry about cold calling the ones that don't. So,
yeah, well, when you get a reach out, it's going to be different than you trying to push yourselves on someone that may or may not want it, right?
That's right.
But kudos to what you have done, because having ran clinics now for 10 years, and the way our model works in British Columbia is kind of odd, where we have Washington State, and they're actually under my direction. I'm responsible for Washington for coordinating their competitive evaluations for practices and stuff like that. But when I run clinics, and I'll ask the question early on to just kind of get a sense for the room, you got 40 coaches in the room, men and women. Okay, how many of you heard of either LTAD, LTPD, ADF, because everybody's got a different name for it.
Yep.
And the U.S. coaches, all of their hands go up. And maybe three or four hands of the Canadian coaches. Okay, we have a problem here. What about physical literacy? All U.S. coaches, hands go up, and a few of the Canadian coaches. So I'm kind of like, what are you guys doing differently? Because I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've been planting this seed for 10 years. Yeah. I know Corey and Paul have done an amazing job of all the materials in the back end, the Hockey Canada app, creating the LTPD model. But it's taking a long time for it to disseminate down to those initial coaches, and some of the guys that are going in their second or third course, because I know you have all the way to level four. But what have you done to get it down to them? Is it strictly PSA based, website based, or is it come up?
No, it's in the curriculum that they go through when they show up at a coaching course. You know, they're exposed to it, you know, online, and you know, and so we are from a messaging standpoint. I think we've used what we call internally the water torture technique. You know, it's that drip, drip, drip of constant information, and it's woven into a little of everything. You know, we have a magazine that goes out to every household. Our magazine editor right here in our office in Colorado Springs, and our ADM messaging is woven throughout that magazine, not in an overt way, but it's referenced continually. And again, it's a kids magazine. It's the largest hockey publication on the planet. It goes out every month to more households than the Hockey News, to any other hockey publication on the planet. So we use that. We've been doing there's a little bit difference in our structures between Hockey Canada and USA Hockey. Your branches have a stronger control over maybe the local
what
goes on than we're a little bit more, things are run or at least distributed a little bit more from the national level. Like, for example, one of our advantages is every player registers directly with USA Hockey and then is recognized by our local affiliate. So Washington State comes back and then they're recognized by the state of Washington to play locally. So we have a contact point. We send out, whether it's a coaching newsletter, e-newsletter every month to our coaches, but we also send something to parents based on the age category that the kid that you have in your household is registered with. So if you're an 8 and under family, right, you're getting our 8 and under newsletter that's geared towards information that we think might be of interest to you with your kid at being an eight-year-old. And the open, now email's not a great communication tool in today's world, but our open rates and our click-through rates are still in the 30-40%, which is
very high.
Very high. Pretty inexpensive way. And again, maybe we're just feeding the ones that want to be fed. Mm-hmm. You know, what I think we've done a good job of is empowering the coach or the parent that knows that something's a little off in the rink to be able to go, hey, you know, USA Hockey's telling me that that's not right. Right. So maybe they are a little more emboldened to step up and go, that's not right. We need to maybe change some behaviors around here. Whereas in the past, it just seemed to be the loudest, you know, yokel in the rink that got their way, right? So, yeah. So the communication tools, it's that constant drip of information that we're trying to get out. And the message gets changed a little bit all the time, saying the same type of thing. So.
And then because you're catering to age groups for the parents, I call the hockey newbies parents. Mm-hmm. They're ones that 5-6-year-old kids, they're the ones that need more information than a lot of the seasoned ones and midget because they've kind of been through the pipeline. But the 5- and 6-year-old, 7-year-old parents, especially when it comes to, and I got to ask the question, I know that USA Hockey is one of many, many organizations, NGBs in the U.S., jumped on board with USA Tennis a few years ago to promote multi-sport participation. What's your take on multi-sport and why should kids avoid, right, I guess ultimately hang up their skates at the end of a winter season and play other sports?
The research is overwhelming on it being a better choice. So it's not public knowledge right now, and I'm probably not supposed to say this, but NHLPA and the NHL did a survey of their membership this year. And you know, self-reported from the National Hockey League players. Because I mean, we've done the same internal, surveys with our own players, but they did this league-wide. 98.6% of the NHL players, basically all self-reported back to the PA, their own organization, that they didn't specialize till after 14. 98.6. So the person that's running around the rink telling you that you have to specialize, how all the best ones turned out, 98.6%. No, like seriously. And a good chunk till 16 and.
Yeah, this would be interesting how long they deferred before they really pulled the trigger and tried to play other sports as well.
The survey was done and it was broken down even by Canadian, American, North American, European, Scandinavian, Russian. So they broke it down by different demographics as well. And so what sports they played, what their influences were, they did a really good job with this, and I'm hoping that they release that information. I probably shouldn't be talking about it.
We'll keep it on the QT, Ken. I won't share.
Yeah, you know, like let's put it out there because it's too good of information to keep under wraps, you know. But we had the same information out there, and then you know, our U.S. Olympic Committee is looked across all sports and done several historic survey of Olympians and Olympic medalists.
Yeah,
you know, and they did one way back. They did one, you know, I think in the 90s. They did one recently. Chris Schneider updated it over at the USOC. And again, multi-sport athletes. So, you know, it just doesn't seem to hold out that that's not the pathway, you know.
Couldn't agree with you more. And look at the NFL, over 90% of their last four drafts. All multi-sport athletes and late multi-sport athletes. Some of them are playing 2-3 sports even in college.
Oh, yeah.
And the most recent Heisman Trophy winner, I'm going to go MLB or I'm going to go to NFL. Like, he was an amazing athlete, right?
So exactly.
The big challenge, though, is how do we get those 5-, 6-, 7-year-old parents not to cave? Because the big push that these – I don't call them predators. I call them – great solicitors, they're great salespeople. They're getting you into this pipeline. But how do they convince them don't have to worry about keeping up with the Joneses? Because that's what I get from everybody.
Of course.
But if we don't do it, he's gonna fall behind.
You know, I think this is where I don't know what kind of success we've had here. You know, again, it's something we message continually. Just before I got on, one of our newsletters, the next article going out to our 12-year-old families, it's an article on Kendall Coyne, you know, who you just talked about earlier, ripping around the rink at the NHL All-Star Game, right? And her multi-sport background growing up. So we continually try and send out that message so that hopefully parents – or at least armed with the right information. We've also done a few small things where we've gotten some local youth programs together. I can't tell you it's been on any type of large scale here, but we've gotten some youth hockey programs, for example, to partner with the youth soccer program. They've said, you know what, during the winter, play ice hockey, and if you're in our club, we promote you going to this youth rink, and then in the off season, that club's promoting, hey, if you choose to go play soccer, well, go play for these guys. You know, trying to share kids a little bit. But I think one of the things that's allowed us to, some of the structures that we've put in place with our practices and practice design, especially early on, have helped provide maybe an avenue for that. If, for example, if you're the 12U coach and you're just practicing on the ice with just your team, okay, and you're missing a couple kids in the fall because they're still finishing up their soccer season, pretty tough to run a practice. But if we're sharing ice with, you know, the three travel, you know, squirt teams or PB teams in our mix, in our club, you know, and we're missing a few players, hey, no problem. I can still run practice. And we try and tell our clubs, you know, tell your kids, look, your soccer season's finishing up. Soccer may take priority right now. They should go do that, you know, if there's a conflict. And then, you know, later on in the year when it's getting down to the end of the hockey season, well, maybe hockey should take a little more of a priority, you know. We just have to be a little more flexible as coaches. Because, again, it's not about me. It's about my kids and their experience and what we do. So there's less pressure on that if we structure some things a little differently.
Yeah, and it helps the parents make more – eases them a little bit because the organizations are endorsing, hey, you should be playing this and this instead of doing it at the same time. One of the challenges we face in BC is that soccer and hockey are direct overlap sports. So if you're a soccer player and want to play hockey, you have to have an organization. And there's a few that have now started to come on board. Mm-hmm. Dave Newsom, actually had him on our last summit. He works for an organization in South Surrey. And they collaborated with their soccer club and said, hey, you know, let's figure out a schedule so the kids, if they do want to play hockey and soccer in the same season, we can figure it out. And they kind of set the bar, and then they were invited to go to a bunch of conferences. And then, oh, they did it. So the adjoining, like literally the neighboring soccer and hockey association did the same thing. Because that's the worst part, is playing multiple sports concurrently.
Yeah, for sure.
So they try to discourage. But if the kid likes to, like, I have a nephew that loves soccer and he loved hockey, but the hockey association said, if you want to try out for the competitive stream, you can only play hockey. And my sister-in-law says, what's up with that? I don't know what to tell you. That's just,
And we have organizations that create those type of issues as well. I mean, for us, we're lucky because, you know, cold weather areas, soccer is not necessarily the December, January, February sport. So
when you played and you were at the university level, when did you specialize, or how many sports were you playing up until you specialized?
You know what? I started playing just ice hockey when I left at 17 to play junior hockey. Moved away from home to play juniors. You know, and then it was, the hockey season was pretty long. It was, you know,
Was 17. That wasn't,
yeah, seven. I was 17. Yeah.
Because there's 7-year-old kids.
For sure.
There's this organization that's popped up in the Lower Mainland, and I know that Corey and company have an issue with it also. There's a similar organization in Ontario where they're actually recruiting 6, 7, and 8-year-old kids to give them extra ice during the winter time. So they're prepping them for spring and summer. So it's like a year-round program. 6, 7, 8-year-old kids. When I saw that, I almost fell out of my chair. I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah. And you know what? The talent idea is the. I've heard this statement by a guy over in Sweden that talent idea is the graveyard of evidence. Right? Like all the dead bodies, so to speak, of 6, 7 year olds that are in that program that never amount to anything.
Yeah.
You know. It's just, we want to point to the one person that actually survived, right? Not the 98% that didn't, or something went wrong with them, you know? So this is why the multi-sport thing is just better balance to our lives. And if you talk to most of our elite sport athletes, they tell you that I learned a lot from those other sports. You know, if you're a team sport guy, like a hockey team, you know, there's some things you can learn from individual sports, you know, more self-reliance, you know, like if it's going to be, it's up to me kind of deal, you know, there's certainly lessons that you can take from each one. So those all help.
Yeah. The lessons as well as the athleticism, like every incremental balance, agility, whatever you're going to learn through other sports will cross over and vice versa.
For sure.
Because as a multi-sport athlete, I was able to teach myself how to ski, golf, tennis, racquetball, you know, I could do anything because I just went as multi-sport. Where analogy, and I just want to jump on the recent success that you have had and Finland has had at the World Juniors and the World Championships. I was fortunate this past winter to go to the World Juniors to see four games. The first one was Czech versus USA in the exhibition. And that was a game where I believe Jack got hurt, and then Quinn went to his aid, and it was interesting to watch. Then I got to see Swiss play and another game, and fortunately, or unfortunately, Canada did not make it into the gold game or in the medal round. So those gold tickets were nothing. Like, people were giving them away, which I could not believe. So I had opportunity to see U.S. again play against Finland. Was it disappointing for you when Finland kind of etched the nods or whatever?
Look, I mean, we're competitive. We want to win. It's disappointing when you don't win.
Yeah.
However, we have a very, our staff internally has a very good working relationship with the Finns. We share a lot of information. For me, right now, they may be the best hockey playing country on the planet. For the size they are, for the resources they have, for what they do with what they have, you know, there certainly isn't anybody better. But there's other good, like I said, there's other good hockey, great hockey playing nations, but they do an unbelievable job, have a ton of respect for them. And you know what? They deserve the game. So, you know, that's what happens. It's sport. And we know we're not going to win every one because there's other great hockey playing nations. Are we upset? Absolutely. You know, but that's sports. Why we play the games. So. Yeah.
But what about world championship? And Finland then pulls it out, rabbit out of the hat. And a lot of people are talking about his name. Just, I can never say the coach's name. But
yeah. Oh, they're the coach.
So, yeah, their coach.
Yeah.
And they go.
He's been fantastic.
Yeah. And they all the commentators say, like, we're joking about the Finnish people saying, we're going to give him the worst. We'll give him the worst hand, the worst team, and see if he'll still pull a rabbit out of the hat. What does he do? He goes and wins the world championship with only two players that play in the NHL.
You know, but again, there's a lot of countries out there that play hockey at a very good level. Finnish Elite League's a great league. KHL's got good players. They have excellent players. Like Kapo's going to one or two coming up here, right? Yeah. So it's not like the cupboard was bare. You know, but people don't understand, too, that the system over there where they're shut down. Their pro leagues are done earlier. Like the Finns had 9 exhibition games before the tournament started. You know, so you have a chance to work on your power play. You have your special teams. You systematically were a little sounder. Mm-hmm. Don't take anything away. They had something to prove. I mean, the team that shows up with the most emotional energy, that goes a long way in a short event like that. So it's like Stanley Cup playoffs. You know, you got to have enough emotional energy left in the tank after that 82 game season to get it done. That ain't easy. So they're a great hockey country.
Yeah. You look at Russia, they go and win all those games and then they petered out right at the wrong time. They go through them and they go through Sweden and then, you know, and then it's like, wow, what an accomplishment. It was kind of interesting. So is there a secret sauce in Finland? Like what have they done differently the last
They've changed, because we get a chance to interact regularly, they've changed their development system considerably in the last 10 years. And because of their size, their ability to be more nimble in that change than behemoths like us in Canada, I see things in the research that come out, and within 2 years, 3 years, they've got it widely distributed amongst their coaches and actually doing it. You'll see it at ice level, which is, you know, the rapid deployment that they're able to do. Again, great people that work really, really hard at this. They are extremely serious about their ice hockey. So
too serious, though, because I knew somebody that went over to their hockey academy and came back. So they're like motor morons. They just hockey.
You know, they're still multi-sport, you know, participation. Their kids are just more well-rounded. Like, I've had the privilege of doing some, quote, dry land training with just the random group of kids. Elementary school kids. You have 60 kids from the local elementary school come over at 10, 11, not 8, 9, 10 years of age. Mm-hmm. The baseline athleticism of the entire group is just a cut above what everybody else is. When I go to look at the same, just having this discussion with an elementary school teacher today, we did 4th, 5th, 6th graders. We did some elementary school work with them this year, and how non-athletic those kids were. And then you get the random group of Finnish kids that show up and how despair the two groups are. So when you're starting out with this, you know what? They have a better chance down the road of being pretty good players. So they're getting it from a lot of different – it's this sporty lifestyle that they, you know – have across their culture. You know, it's in school, like the school's going to shut down this week so everyone can go on a ski vacation, right? So everyone's going cross-country skiing. Whole country, you know, like they do these things for physical activity, and their families take vacations to go to on a physical holiday where they'll go and the kids are going to do a little soccer and maybe try some tennis and mom and dad are going to play tennis and golf. And, you know, like culturally it's different. So we have work as a society, we have our work cut out for us. That's where all of this across the board, as we were talking about earlier, really important that all of us sport organizations and people that are communicating these messages are on the same page trying to get the word out, because it's not ice hockey, it's not soccer, it's not lacrosse, it's not basketball, football, whatever that's the problem. It's our North American sport, youth sport culture. That's where our issues lie.
Yeah, and it's not a culture anymore. It's a $17 billion industry.
Yes.
So because the monetization of the model, how do you
you know, but see,
the bubble's going to burst.
You know, well, but here's the, I laugh because if you, we've got a guy that is involved with us, was one of our early adopters, so to speak, and happened to, and he made his money in, not in the youth sports area, but his kids liked hockey and figure skating, so he buys an ice rink, you know, for his kids, so to speak, right? Starts that business, is doing that. And, you know, he's like, this ADM thing is the greatest thing ever. I show up, my parking lot is filled, the concession line is, you know, six people deep.
Yeah.
He actually is like, look, I had to go on and build another sheet, a multi-million dollar additional pad to my facility because I couldn't keep up with the demand.
Wow.
There's a way to do this that reduces cost, spreads things out, doesn't overdo it. You know, instead of going on to 100 families and trying bleeding them dry year round, why not cycle through 1,000 families, give them all a great little experience and exposure to ice hockey. And you know what, from a business, you know, economically, that's probably a little bit better business model. So you don't have to sell your soul to do something good for the kids, expose them to the sports that they may or may not like, you know. And so those are the ways to run a business.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I'm the big believer. One of my past lives, I was a buyer for Costco for 8 years. The whole salmon story, sales drives margin. Mm-hmm. The more people you get in the pipeline, the better the pipeline becomes, the more cost-effective, economies of scale. Instead of that, like you said, bleed 100. Well, let's get 1,000. Well, what about 10,000? What about, you know, like just get more and more? Because the more kids you have in the pipeline, the more grassroots, and it's going to feed the top. Because the top is coming down because there's nobody coming in. So,
yeah.
Total sidebar question. Officiating is a big challenge for us in Canada. We've been continuously experiencing similar rates. Like we've got about 10,000 across the country. We lose about 3,300 like clockwork every year. 30% of our officials quit every year. 50% the first year. Do you see the same trends? And if so, what are you doing?
Well, absolutely we do. We just had our annual governance meetings this past week, our annual Congress, and it was a big topic within our board, within our membership that was there at Congress. And I can't say that we have the right plan going forward just yet, but it's something that organizationally we know we need to prioritize right now and really try and make some changes, because the abusiveness of our society against officials, like, you know, when you're, look at the NHL playoffs right now, like they expect perfection at level. You know, human beings are human beings. They make mistakes. The perfection is not it's not attainable when human beings are involved. But they're looking at the vitriol that sometimes you see in the ice rink from pounding on the glass on maybe some 15-year-old official. It's just not right. And that culture, again, needs to change because they see it on TV or they see it someplace else. They think that 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 behavior is okay. And it's not. So we have our hands full. We know it. I know that internally it's a very hot topic right now. And can't tell you we have a great solution just yet, but we're willing to work the problem.
Yeah, I think if we all kind of, it's like we when we just started collaboration and figuring out how we can make this better, because I'm kind of, I interact with so many different sports groups, and I even created a module, how to attract, retain, and grow your officials. And they're going, this is great, but how do we deal with the parents? And I'm going, it's not about dealing with the parents, about engaging and supporting them. So that's the biggest challenge we're facing in that space. So kind of touched all those Denver questions. What's your I'm going to ask the last question before we get a deep dive. Okay. Your proudest accomplishment to date working at USA?
That's a tough one, because I like I said, I've had two lives with USA Hockey. Life one, really fortunate to be around at the right time with a group of players, you know, to get off the bus with the best players, so to speak. And so I was around when our first team, U.S. team, won an under 18 gold medal, and our first U.S. team won a under 20 world championship. So I got to be involved in those things. So in that life, those were wonderful. And now in the last, I think it's just this, the day-to-day satisfaction that knowing that coming to work with some really my friends, and to kind of know that, to see that we're kind of making a little bit of a difference right now. Things are going in the right direction. Is it perfect? No, we got a long ways to go. We've probably just picked the low hanging fruit here. So it's probably going to get a lot harder as we go forward, but knowing that we're making, going to leave the sport better than what we found it. Like, that's probably the greatest enjoyment that we all have, but I do get to come and work with my friends. That's it's a really cool thing. So
it's not really like work. It's like a passion of love. You know, when you, the analogy is, if you love what you do, you never work another day in your life. And I love what I do. I love to be able to make a living making a difference. But, you know, what the work that you guys have been doing with USA Hockey, and everybody talks about it, you know, what can we do to move that needle in that same direction? Because when you're growing, that's fantastic. And where you see most other sports that are doing the other way around. So kudos to you and everybody there. I mean, I had a great chat with Bob Mancini. So last deep dive questions. Do you have a book that you recommend for grassroots coaches, guys that are in your pipeline?
You know, I read a lot, but I don't read a lot of books that I think people would be all that interested in. Like right now, I'm just finishing Nonlinear Pedagogy and Skill Acquisition. Like, you know, these are more scientific stuff. But I would say maybe, you know, just when we're considering youth sports, maybe The Energy Bus by John Gordon. Bring a positive outlook and how infectious that is for your kids. And I think that's just really important in the youth culture. Maybe even parents, something along those lines as well. I don't know. There's a couple others probably. We're fortunate to live in a community where the U.S. Olympic Committee is located. There's a couple of universities here. And there's a book that's just come out, The Adulteration of Children's Sports. It's written by a faculty member over at Colorado College here, Christy Ertl. And it's looking at a lot of the research that's out there and how adults have just, we've kind of screwed it up for kids.
Yep.
And we've taken the intrinsic motivation out away from them in youth sports. But the good news is, we made the problem, but we as adults can fix it. And we have that in our control. So I think it's not necessarily light reading. but yeah, that might be something for parents for sure.
Perfect. Last question for coaches. What would you recommend that they do to shave 5 years off their learning curves, or should they?
Well, obviously learning is lifelong, like we talked about, but just having some patience. Like, if you go around, I was talking with Joe Bonnet, one of our regional managers today, and he made the point, he said, you know, we have a lot of youth organizations out there that if you look at their mission statement or you talk to their hockey director or the other people in the organization, they never say, well, we're a sport, youth sports club that our whole focus is on winning. Never say that. But somehow our youth coaches all internalize that their sole job is to go out and try and win a bunch of youth sport games versus, you know, providing the right experience for kids first. So for me, it's patience, slowing down on that winning thing, and then understanding that spending your time on the culture that you create around your program, culture first. You know, the best environment for your kids, for your families that are involved. We tell our programs out there that we don't want you to be just the best youth hockey program. We want you to provide the best youth sports experience possible. We want you to be a world-class youth sports organization. Well, what goes into that? And it's just so much beyond the X's and O's. Mm-hmm. It's all the winning and losing is all secondary if you create the right culture around what you're doing. So focus there, right?
Nailed it. I mean, and that whole winning concept, I've surveyed, I don't know, 15 years coaching, I'd say about 400 kids, all the different teams, all different sports. And the three questions I ask them in the beginning of the season, why are they playing that sport? So it could be hockey, baseball, because I coach a bunch of them. Number one answer comes out of their mouths is because it's fun, right? Like every kid, that's what they say. It's fun. Okay, what's fun about it? And then you get all kinds of, like Amanda Visick's research where she shared the fun maps.
For sure.
I never had a kid ever say winning. She had 48th out of 81 characteristics. So correct. 47 other reasons and a whole bunch of other. But the big one was being with their friends, loving the game, working on their skills. You know, when they had coaches that really treat them respectfully, you belong with their buddies. Those are the things we should be focusing on. But what are we focusing on? The least fun activities Amanda outlined is the travel tournaments, working with specialty trainers, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, we need to shift the model back to the kids. And that's really what this is all about, what I'm trying to share with everybody. And I loved your insight. I love learning a little bit more about your program. And thanks for making the time for it. So how do people follow the great work that you guys are doing?
USAHockey.com, our main website. ADMKids.com is our sort of our auxiliary, spinoff. You can connect through either through our site or around, you know, an end around a little bit. I'm on Twitter, at Ken M Hockey. I don't tweet out a whole lot, but usually stuff around youth and youth sports and that I get from other people that I know are pretty good that want to share with people. So, online's probably the best, usahockey.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Like, it's really
welcome.
A great chat. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook, For Love of the Game, Twitter, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.